This is the Future of HR Podcast, episode 145.
This is what has most evolved in my approach to developing a high-performing HR team, this very structured process. Literally, we started with why do we exist as an HR function within this company? Towards what end? With what purpose? And how do we work to deliver on that? And then what our values are, what we look like as a function in terms of how we structure ourselves, our capabilities. And then we thought about the people strategy. So that very structured end-to-end process and bringing the team along with shared ownership and having their back was critical.
How can you create a people strategy that aligns to and drives your business strategy? What is a people P&L and why does your organization need one? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR Podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career to the next level. If you're really serious about becoming a more business-focused and strategic HR leader, then you need to make attending my Next Gen HR Accelerator program a part of your 2025 development plan. And if you're a CHRO who wants your HR team to have even more influence and business impact, then you're going to want to send your team to my Next Gen HR Accelerator program as well. Because my Next Gen HR Accelerator program is a best-in-class leadership development program specifically designed to equip high-potential HR talent with the skills, mindset, and tools they need to become strategic business leaders and value creators. Over four intensive weeks, you'll build your business acumen and financial acumen. You'll sharpen your strategic thinking, elevate your executive influence and communication skills, and learn how to translate business strategy to HR initiatives that deliver impact and value. You also get targeted feedback and coaching to help you grow as a leader, as every NextGen HR Accelerator participant receives 360 feedback, personal coaching from me, and leaves with a targeted from-to development plan. That is why one past participant said the NextGen HR Accelerator program completely transformed their approach to HR. Over the past year, over 100 HR leaders have been through the program from companies like Verizon, McDonald's, Nike, Prudential, Pacific Life, Hershey, Kohler, and many more. Our next cohort starts September 9th and registration is now open. Space is limited and we expect to sell out. To learn more about the Next Gen HR Accelerator program, go to futureofhr.com or reach out to me directly to learn more. My guest this week is Anita Graham. Anita is the Executive Vice President and Chief Human Resources Officer for LabCorp, which is a global life sciences and healthcare company with 70,000 employees around the world. And prior to LabCorp, Anita led HR and public affairs at VF Corporation, one of the world's largest lifestyle-focused footwear and apparel companies. And as you will soon learn, Anita is an experienced business leader who has led HR for four Fortune 500 companies, including her time at VF Corporation and her current role at LabCorp. Anita has an impressive track record and demonstrates a talent for bringing together people, technology, and driving strategic transformation, all capabilities that are crucial for HR leaders navigating change in their organization today. And with her experience leading four HR functions, Anita is going to share her wisdom and insights on what it takes to build a business-focused HR strategy, a high-performing HR leadership team, and what she calls a people P&L. In addition, Anita holds board-level roles in several professional organizations, including the Human Resources Policy Association, the Center for Executive Compensation, and the Center on Executive Succession. She's also a member of the National Board for the Trust for Public Lands. I know you're going to join this conversation with Anita as we discuss why taking initiative matters for your career and how early career professionals can develop the skill, why you should be intentional with your career choices but remain open to unexpected opportunities, how to build an aligned and high-performing HR leadership team, why you need a people P&L and the impact it can have on your business, and why you should think about your HR strategy in 3 to 5 year time frames. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode as you listen, so drop me a line on LinkedIn and say hello. And now let's jump into my conversation with Anita. Anita, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. How are you?
Hey, JP. I'm doing really well. Excited to be here with you today.
Yeah, I am excited to have you on the podcast. Excited to let everyone get to know you a little bit more. And I want to start off really about your HR journey, because it really started in undergraduate class at Cornell, where you fell in love with the field. But after graduating and working for a few years, you went back to get an MBA from NYU, and you're taking night classes. So tell us more about why you made the decision and how going to get that MBA helped your career.
My father was a mathematician. Growing up, I never wanted to disappoint him with my math grades. So I gravitated towards the social sciences and languages much more than towards anything having to do with numbers. I ended up in the industrial and labor relations program at Cornell. And as you mentioned, kind of fell in love beginning with my HR Management 101 course. And while my undergraduate education, I would say, prepared me well with the technical skills across a variety of HR areas of expertise, I realized quickly that what really energized me was the business and the impact that I could have with my HR skills if I really understand the dynamics and drivers of the business. I decided that getting my MBA would better equip me as a business leader, and doing so as a corporate finance major rather than, say, an organizational behavior major was the right approach to challenge myself to understand value creation and ultimately have that ability to combine the human capital and the financial capital sides of the value creation equation. I did the part-time program at the Stern School at NYU. That meant 4+ years of night classes while trying to do well at work and grow my career. But with hindsight, it was an excellent way to do it because I really could apply learnings either directly or indirectly in my work along the way. After that, the MBA was an important signal, I would say, of my business orientation and focus, especially as I was considered for new opportunities. And it was really practical. Again, when you're sitting around the table with leaders who are running various parts of your company, you end up talking a lot about the numbers, the financial, the cost and revenue drivers. You end up talking a lot about people. Those two things coming together, I think, has been a real life changer for me in terms of my ability to grow in this career.
Yeah, I think it's so great because I think we in HR, we do need to have that business focus and business mindset. And it can be hard in a lot of our undergraduate or even graduate school programs. We don't cover that if it's HR focused. So it's good that you did that. How do you think about what kind of advice might you give a early career HR person who's thinking about getting an MBA versus getting like a master's in industrial relations or IO psych? How would you kind of make those trade-offs in your mind?
The way I thought about it is, what was I missing from my undergraduate experience and what was the best way to make it up rather than try to go deep in one area? Because I really didn't know what within HR I wanted to do. And I felt that the broader exposure I got to the subject matter in HR, and I took every imaginable graduate class from compensation through to labor relations, through to staffing and things like that. That point, I felt like there's really not much else I'm going to go deep on in org development or things like that. And I really wanted to supplement the learning. So that's how I thought about it. And I would encourage people to think that way based on what they want to achieve and the objectives that they have for themselves. I mean, if they're really passionate about leadership development, organizational behavior, then by all means, do that. You do get basic grounding in the MBA program around a lot of business management disciplines. But to be able to go deep on valuing a company, that was one of the things that I had to do plenty of in the finance side. So really understanding valuation, how investors, how stakeholders look at valuation, and then what are the levers management can pull to drive valuation in a sustained way, creating value for your customers, creating value for your shareholders, creating value for your employees, because ultimately companies sustain employees through providing career and job opportunities. That was what jazzed me. That's how I chose the finance orientation.
Yeah, that's really helpful advice to think that through and to thinking about what you're not maybe getting in your current program, what's missing, what are the gaps, and how you could fill those. But you're obviously, Anita, also a big believer in taking initiative, like you did to go get your MBA, rather than waiting to be tapped on the shoulder. Can you share a pivotal moment in your career where you raised your hand for an opportunity that really just helped change the trajectory of your career?
Partway through my first year of my MBA, I took a role as a pension plan administrator at an investment firm. And I had loved my first job out of college. And I was so fortunate to have a manager who pushed and challenged and believed in me. But the circumstances in that organization just were not optimal for growth. And I knew I wanted to grow. That was during the mid-90s. As Wall Street was going through a period of blissful growth ahead of the dot-com bubble, the financial services industry was shifting and consolidating in really profound ways. The firm I joined was in growth mode itself. And if you wanted personal and career growth and you were willing to put yourself out there, this was the place to be. Within 6 weeks of my start day, I actually received an unexpected promotion as a more senior level role became open. And then all of a sudden, I was working across both the defined benefit pension plan space and the defined contribution, what we know now as 401k management space. By the way, I really didn't know how to administer a defined benefits plan or a defined contribution plan for that matter. I really leaned into the learning and I loved the learning, which is what I believe my leaders saw in me. About 9 months later, as the firm was expanding globally, we needed to build an expatriate management capability, which we just simply did not have. My manager at the time mentioned this need during a staff meeting as an FYI. And later I said to her that I'd be willing to help and support those first few expats that we were sending outside the US. So from an expediency standpoint, that was really an easy solution for her. And all of a sudden, I was managing expatriate assignments. We went from zero to 20 or 30 in the first year. It was a big, heavy lift. This sequence repeated itself a number of times over the next 6 years in this company where I would raise my hand when a business need was emerging to either lead something or just be part of a team working on something. Ultimately, I became the youngest person to become partner SVP in that firm, and I was leading total rewards, M&A, integration, and international HR. Overall, there were three things that were essential to my ability to grow in this way, and I would say in no particular order, but it was the dynamic environment that I was working in, my curiosity and learning orientation and being vocal about that, and then the mentorship and sponsorship that I received from my managers and the CHRO, and also what I learned from my peers and my teams, right? Because learning doesn't apply up sideways or down, it applies in all directions. And by the way, this journey was not without its ups and downs, the occasional flops and failures. So humility and empathy were also really huge learnings from this period of time.
Yeah, no kidding. What an amazing learning experience. And I love that you just raised your hand. And a lot of us are in meetings with our boss or other leaders, they mention a need, but not everyone sends an email or says, hey, I'd love to help. How can I take ownership for that? And then follows through. And I think that is a big differentiator. But I'm sure that, gosh, I mean, you have pension plans, all that. You did not know that stuff. So you had to learn on the job and figure it out and continue to move forward. That's truly impressive. But after that, you end up landing a divisional head of HR role in a biotech and then becoming the CHRO over that time period. And then about 2 years later, you were recruited to be the EVP and CHRO for Shire Pharmaceuticals. And while that's impressive, it's even more impressive, Anita, to learn that you were only 32 years old when you became a CHRO for the first time. So since that time, you've led HR for four Fortune 500 companies, including your current company, LabCorp. So with that said, all that experience, what advice do you have to give to next-gen HR leaders who have their sights set on the C-suite?
Yeah, I definitely was a baby CHRO, as referred to oneself when you first step into the role. But and I was definitely young, and there was a lot that I didn't know. And there's a lot we could talk about here, by the way, because we know we still have work to do to ensure that we're consistently preparing our next generation of HR leaders. And that's what you do is so important, by the way. So thank you for that. But, you know, preparing them within our own companies to have the support of the CEO and the support of the board to step into the C-suite as a CHRO for the first time, because that's where I find the hesitancy comes in. Here's the advice I would give. First of all, I would say that careers are made through a combination of intentionality and serendipities. I do think you need to know what you want to achieve over at least the next 5 to 10 years, even if you're not certain beyond that, and take intentional steps via your role, your assignment, or your company choice. By the way, the company you choose to go to and the state that it's in, the leaders you work for, are some of the most important choices you're going to make in your career. So you have to be intentional, but you also have to be open to paths that become available more serendipitously because you happen to be in the right place at the right time, right? I happened to be in a place that was very dynamic, had a lot of new needs we had to build, but then it took actually putting myself out there, taking a risk, and somebody taking a risk on me in order to be able to deliver. The other thing I would say is, as you take one of these paths that might come about, again, more serendipitously, your objectives may need to shift, and they would certainly require a rethink in terms of what you want to achieve from your career, because you might step into something that you love or you hate. You'll have many learnings from all of that, but it should certainly inform how you think about your future. I would say seek coaching, reflect deeply, and stay curious. Leadership is personal, not just positional, and I think those are all important things to think about. Specifically for next generation HR leaders with C-suite aspirations, the important thing is that the path is not just about mastering HR. It's really about shaping the business. And I know this is now said pretty commonly, and I've always said that HR leaders need to think of themselves as business leaders with HR expertise, not the other way around. So this means that you really have to understand the business model, the cost drivers I talked about earlier, market dynamics in your environment, and strategy as deeply as your CEO or CFO, honestly. Your credibility will come from demonstrating how talent, culture, org design, all the things that are the fodder of HR, how they fuel business performance and drive value creation. Beyond engagement and retention, you really need to be able to talk about productivity, growth, innovation, risk, and then quantify the impact of HR initiatives on financial outcomes and strategic goals. That's the place where we have all wanted to get. I think we're getting, as a function, as an area of expertise, we're getting much closer to that than we have before. I'd also say data and technology. Great HR leaders use data and tell really compelling stories that drive executives to act. So you need to understand AI, digital tools, and how they're reshaping work. And you have to be an active user yourself. I know someone that gauges how technically savvy the IT function is actually by asking them about their own personal use of technology. And that's, you would expect that, but you'd be surprised that not everyone thinks that way. I think we all have to be technologists from that standpoint. We don't have to know how to write code, but we have to understand the tools, and we have to partner with the CIO or the CTO to help the workforce adapt and, of course, thrive in this new tech-enabled enterprise. A couple of other things I'd add. If you have the opportunity to move beyond core HR and take roles in strategy or operations, commercial functions, or leading transformation, consider it seriously. These lateral experiences just help you lead cross-functionally better, build organizational trust. And by the way, the same goes for international assignments. Build coalitions and trust. So leaders influence through relationships, not just positional power, right? It's really the relationships and the credibility that you have. So you have to build trust with your stakeholders. And then have courage. Speak the truth. Push for what matters. Be known as the leader who challenges with purpose, but challenge, because we're not going to make change without that.
Yeah, that is a lot to unpack, Anita. There's so much in there. But I love what you talked about, this idea of intentionality and serendipity. The red thread through all we talked about there is the intentional piece of being intentional about being a business leader, getting the right experiences, having courage, pushing yourself out of your comfort zone, taking roles outside of HR. If you do all those things, like you did really early in your career, you're very intentional about really making a difference, then the serendipity happens because you have proven yourself, you have those experiences. And so now you have more luck, if you will, because People will see, well, look at all these experiences you've had, right? So serendipity sort of goes hand in hand with being intentional. I love that advice. So helpful.
Yeah, you create your own luck, if you will, in that sense. It does come to risk-taking, and it's hard because until you've sat in the seat or done the role, you haven't done the role, and you don't know exactly what you're doing. And that's normal, by the way, for everyone. And I think sometimes we may overthink our own readiness for something because we haven't done that thing before. But if we have the initiative, the curiosity, which I think is just something we need to cultivate in ourselves, this desire to do things that have impact for the business, for people and our organizations, that's all it takes.
Yeah, I love that point too. There's always someone's first time being a CHRO or whatever role it is. Someone has to take a chance on you and you're going to learn on the job. And it's always tough. I mean, you hear this from interns who are trying to get their start saying, well, I've got great education, but I don't have experience. So there's the catch 22. I hear from other VPs of HR. They're like, I want to be a CHRO, but everyone's looking for someone who's sat in the seat. Depending on where we're at, really does go back to that CEO, what they're looking for and what they really, really want. But we only hire people who have been a CHRO before. We never have new CHROs, no new talent. So we have to take a chance on some people once in a while. And to your point, hey, you might be able to do it even though you don't feel like you can. You're going to figure it out, right? You're going to learn on the job because you just don't know what you don't know. But if you've done the right things, you're hopefully prepared to be successful.
Absolutely. I think it's a good question, by the way, to challenge with, especially if you're sitting as a CHRO and potentially taking a chance on someone stepping into the C-suite who will be a peer, really understanding why your CEO might want an experienced or a person that's sat in the seat. What is it that they're worried about? What is it they're trying to ensure? Because there are ways to prove that someone with the requisite experiences and the right approach will succeed. They might need support in doing so, but we all do. Even experienced leaders need that. It's a good question to challenge your CEO with.
Yeah, and you have led HR and built many HR functions and teams throughout your career. And so I want to talk to you a little more about critical success factors in developing a high-performing HR team. And how has your view changed on this over the years from being, what did you say, a baby CHRO, which I think is really a funny comment, to now being an experienced CHRO?
Yeah, I have had the opportunity to build and rebuild the HR team and the broader function several times, both in terms of selecting my team, but also building skills and competencies of the function. So at LabCorp, the HR function was really rich in terms of quality of the talent, but we were in the midst of a spin in 2023 when I started, and we had over 200 of our team depart with the newly spun-off company. So pretty much immediately, I had two open spots on my HR leadership team, along with a couple of impending retirements. While I wanted to take time to assess the team, I also needed to start rebuilding the team right away. As a team, we started with, pretty much in my first couple of weeks, a new team and leader assimilation process, which was really critical to starting the conversation about what we wanted to build together. And I was clear that I intended to fully engage the team in doing so. We owned things together. So we went through a process to clarify our mission and our purpose as an HR function, our values in terms of how we work together and with all of our stakeholders. Then we went through our organizational design and finally our people strategy at LabCorp. For instance, every single new addition to our HR senior leadership team was selected by the entire HR senior leadership team. And that was really important because we had new leaders coming in. We were asking them to be change agents and drive new programs and new ways of working within our organization. And we needed them to know that we all had their back in doing so and that we would all work as a team. This is what has most evolved in my approach to developing a high-performing HR team, this very structured process. End to end, literally, we started with why do we exist as an HR function within this company? Towards what end, with what purpose, and how do we work to deliver on that? And then what our values are, what we look like as a function in terms of how we structure ourselves, our capabilities. And then we thought about the people strategy. So that very structured end-to-end process and bringing the team along with shared ownership and having their back was critical. The other thing, and this is something we all learn as leaders, acting on issues in the organization in a timely and decisive way is really important. And that can be difficult when you're a new leader, but also when you're an entrenched leader, right? Difficult for different reasons. But you have to, because you owe that to the organization, right? So address issues promptly and make the change you need to make at the right time, always being vigilant and continuing to evolve at a pace that will keep the function sharp, deeply engaged with the entire enterprise and with where our business is going. I learned these lessons with each time that I did this. When I started the LabCorp, just bringing all that together, doing it in the sequence, doing it with the team in this focused way, addressing the issues that we have. And by the way, every organization will have issues. You're never going to get to the state or you're not. So this is an ongoing process. We've defined a way of working as a senior HR team, and then with our leaders underneath us, we're diving deep to bring a lot of great things for our people as we go forward.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Thank you for being so transparent about that. So it sounds like over your career, you've realized there's a little bit of a playbook, more intentionality of how do I bring the team together, get an alignment on mission, that we're going to be one team, we're going to attack this and really help the business in a certain way. And you've really just built that process over time. Whereas probably when you first started as a CHRO, you didn't really think about it the same way, right? Because you're,
yes,
there's just so much going on.
There were intuitive things in terms of knowing the key capabilities you need just to deliver. The day-to-day can be a challenge depending on the state of the organization or what's needed. But following the sort of the steps I learned over the years and doing them in a particular order, in a particular way, being very clear about my own leadership style with my team and really engaging my team so that we all feel like we own it. That was something that emerged over time as a best practice for me.
And if you were a new CHRO, maybe stepping into a new organization, how would you recommend they approach evaluating HR's function, the structure, just in terms of strengths and gaps? You know, knowing that to your point, every organization has challenges, but also every business is in a different state of maturity or business cycle.
Exactly. There will always be differences, and you need to take those into account depending on the unique circumstances of the organization. I've had the chance to stand up brand new, large, publicly traded organization, for instance, because I was out in my career once before. So that required a different set of tools. But you know, I have generally taken the approach that's consistent around engaging with key leaders within my team and across the rest of the organization, including all the business units and other corporate functions, to learn about where the HR function has been, what works well, what doesn't work well, how does the function help the rest of the company thrive, what are its biggest accomplishments, who are its stars, and so forth. So some time ago, actually, as I was doing this for like the third time, I decided that I was going to codify the questions that I have to ask. And I pose the same questions to everyone because that gives me a broad range of perspectives on really key things. And that consistency is really good because you can really dial into the underlying things there, the good and the bad, if you will. Obviously, hearing what my predecessor has to say is valuable. Input from the CEO and the rest of the C-suite is absolutely critical. But I would say you have to go on a deep listening tour with stakeholders first and foremost, and refrain from jumping to conclusions or assumptions too quickly, because you can be sure that there will be plenty of wide-ranging opinions out there, but it's your task to make the right informed assessment. This is true, by the way, whether you're coming in from the outside or promoted to the role from within. From there, a current state of strengths and gaps emerges. If you're coming in from the outside, you're going to be drinking from several fire hoses because as you're doing your deep listening, you're also learning the business and learning the people and the personalities, the strategy, the priorities, and trying to assess the HR functional capabilities. There's a lot there coming from the outside, but evaluating all of the areas, perhaps using a maturity model. You mentioned that concept earlier to assess where each area is, talent acquisition, talent development, et cetera. But you're looking at the functions, you're looking at the operating model and structure. For instance, What are the tension areas, if you will, between the business partners and the COEs, the clarity of roles, capabilities, capacity in the organization, your tech stack, understanding the state of the employee experience, looking at what are the key people metrics, where are we struggling, where are we winning in the market for talent. And I think really importantly, too, is assessing the HR team mindset. How strategic is the team thinking? How agile are they? Are they able to influence? So I would say that's really the roadmap. There are tools out there for a lot of these things, but you are trying to really put the feelers out in a lot of different directions and then synthesize the learnings and connect the learnings. And you do that through this sort of ongoing set of dialogues and evaluating data and hard facts in terms of how the function is doing. A lot of meetings, a lot of talking, a lot of listening, talking in terms of asking questions, not a lot of talking in terms of, I think we should do this or I think we should do that. Again, unless you're stepping into a situation that requires that. And there are situations like from there, I have the roadmap I described before of how we pull the team together and really start to own our transformation together, because you're not going to do it alone. And if you don't have the right team, you're certainly not going to accomplish it. So
then from what you do there, Anita, is you then bring that back into the HR leadership team and say, hey, let's take a look at what I'm seeing, especially if you're a new CHRO. What's your perspective? How do we start to attack and prioritize this and really uncover, but make them part of the process and the journey? That makes a lot of sense.
There is a playbook, but you really have to be open-minded, because if you're not open-minded, you're going to miss something or you're going to misinterpret something. It's very easy and in the early days to do that. Organizations are usually more complex than they appear. Definitely learned that as well over time.
Really helpful. Really interesting to hear that perspective and not just follow in a playbook, but be open to improv, as you said, and really be open to what you maybe don't know, right? Because you can't bring your playbook from the last company to the same company. It doesn't always work. So you've got to be flexible to know that it could shift. Thinking about high-performing HR functions, what metrics do you believe CHROs or business leaders are looking at and kind of saying, hey, what really matters when you think about this? What does that look like from a metric standpoint? How do you judge that we're doing a good job?
There are clearly the metrics that all business leaders will look for their businesses. So that's going to include your core metrics about talent, talent retention, hiring rates, mobility, termination rates, differences by population type, understanding the things that impact the P&L in the business from a talent standpoint. Those are metrics that are critical to be able to know and understand the drivers of those metrics. And you can lean into a business challenge pretty easily having those metrics. From there, you really start to build on to, I would say, higher level, higher order metrics, which really drive your more strategic long-term outcomes around the business. So there's some typical things that I like to look at that's around talent outcomes that are business aligned. So do we have the leadership bench strength? What is our internal mobility rate? What does retention for high potentials look like? What are your leadership pipelines look like? Those are the next order of things. We're starting to look at engagement, and it's not just engagement for the sake of engagement. There's the ENPS, the Employee Net Promoter Score. That's something I've looked at for many years, and I think you can tie it back to business outcomes very easily. So looking at things that help to build a workforce that cares about what they do, that understands what they do to serve the customer, that feels supported, that feels that managers care about them, that workforce will be much more dynamic in the sense of being willing and able to change, to drive change, to take on new initiatives, to care about what's happening with the customer and innovate around that. And you have to start to tell these stories with the data. We have a wonderful state of talent set of slides that we're producing now, sort of refined them we're producing quarterly. But the next level of that, it's like, oh, let's not just look at the data. It's the storytelling with the data that we need to do. And that's what one of the skills that we're looking to make sure our leaders, our HR business partners are equipped with. So they actually proactively can bring something that I hope evolves into what I call a people P&L. It's the key metrics that actually each leader should care about as much as they care about their financial P&L, because they know that if those metrics are trending in the right direction, their financial P&L is going to trend in the right direction. So that's the next level of where I'd like us to head with all of our data dashboards. That requires, again, curiosity and digging in, because some outcomes aren't intuitively tied to certain actions, and you have to point it out and you have to show the data behind it. So that's how I ultimately measure the success of the function, is what's the business impact we're driving on the things that matter for the business. How do people feel working here? Do they feel like they're contributing, they're making a difference, they're being supported? Because we know that those people make better decisions for the customer. And we have a lot of customer-facing employees every day who deal with people who are taking care of their health, and we need them to be at their best doing that. So that's how we're thinking about the impact we're driving.
Yeah, I love that people P&L concept. I think that's really smart, tying back to business impact, but also the people piece that would help drive the P&L and revenue and all those good things that are so important for the business. So I love that concept. It really well said.
And I need to actually define it for us. But I think as we've talked about it with our leaders, they're actually really excited to look at what we think, based on data, is actually going to drive their outcomes. So they're excited to engage with us. And I'm actually really hopeful that we're going to get this done this year.
Great. And maybe trademark people P&L. And
there you go. You
can see it on some t-shirts or coffee mugs. But
that's right. HR drives people P&L.
There you go. That's even getting better. Well, thinking about, you know, having a people P&L, you also have to have a good people strategy. And just love your thoughts a little bit around, how do you think about building a people strategy? What mistakes sometimes people make when putting these together?
When we talk about strategy, I think it's important to remind ourselves that strategy is about making choices. Choices about what to do and choices about what not to do. So we'd all love to do all these great programs for our people and our business, but not most of us don't have the resources, the time, and the wherewithal to do that. So we have to be strategic in the choices that we make. And to me, that's what strategy is really all about. I think it sounds bigger than it is from that standpoint, but there's a process that you go through, because there will be a lot of great ideas and thoughts that are presented in terms of places we could focus, but really only a few should make it to the level of focus and delivering. The way I think about that is, it starts with the business strategy. That is the North Star of everything we should be doing within the HR function and our people strategy. And the people strategy is not an HR strategy. It is truly a people strategy for the business. And I do this with my team. So this, again, is not just a leader setting this out. And do this with your team. We really take the business strategy and talk about the strategy, meaning what does this mean we have to be able to do and deliver as a company in terms of competencies, skills, the way we work, the things that our people need to succeed, the talent that we need to do that, et cetera. So you almost take every element of the business strategy and take it back to its sort of its core drivers of what enables that strategy to come to life. There'll be technology aspects, investment aspects, and people aspects in each of these priorities from the business standpoint. So we focus here on the people side, and we actually draft the people strategy elements. And we do that. You can do that without getting a lot of input, because you're really, as long as you understand the business strategy, you can start and have a draft of what you think the people strategy needs to be. And then you go and test it out with your business. So you talk with your business leaders about how you're thinking about what this means. You get their input. It's an iterative process that you go through. And then we gather back up and talk through all of that and refine. And then we have second bite of the apple, going back and talking with the same business leaders and maybe some other stakeholders at that point. We engage members of the HR team further down into the organization. I've even done employee focus groups with this to say, this is how we're thinking of the strategy. What are your thoughts? And so we select high potential employees from around the company and do that. So you can really take this to whatever level you want. It does depend on how much change you're going to be driving in the organization with the people strategy for how much engagement you have to do sort of upfront. And then you set on your pillars. I think about strategy as a 3 to 5 year exercise. So when you set your strategy pillars, you don't want to change them every year. You only change them the following year if there's some massive disruption in your business, right? And you have to change course. So the pillars really serve as anchors so that you can focus your initiatives and your activities and your resources and your investments over the coming years, right? And so each year you make priorities that move the needle on each of the strategy pillars. And then at the end of the year, we revisit, take the next set of steps to advance the strategy. That repeats itself. I have found that the pillars do tend to be sustainable if they're designed right for at least 3 years. It's very worthwhile to do the exercise every 3 years, no matter what. And you have to keep it fresh. So your initiatives have to shift. You have to sort of take things to the next level so that you can realize the strategy. You have to measure yourself. You have to keep it on the HR SLT agenda. You have to talk about it, and you have to talk about it with your teams. So it's a process very typical to how you develop the enterprise strategy, by the way, but it is fully driven by that enterprise strategy and by the priorities and choices that you need to make. Because again, you're not going to be able to do everything you want to do or that you think even think should be done. But if you make a compelling argument for the investments needed to drive these most important initiatives, the likelihood is you'll get it. That's really the objective. And the business knows how we're working around supporting them, enabling them, and partnering with them to deliver for our customers and for our stakeholders. I've done this a number of times, and it's a great thing to do because it really engages the entire HR team in understanding why we're here and the impact we're having. It gives you a way of communicating consistently who your teams across, we have a global team, so communicating across the world where we are, how we're moving the function along, and how we're serving the business. So it serves as a great anchor for that communication as well.
Thank you, Anita. That's very helpful to hear more about how you think about people's strategy from that kind of comprehensive viewpoint and how you can get to implementation. Last question for you, and you know this question's coming. What is one word or phrase you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, I thought a lot about this one, actually, since I know you always ask it. And I was torn. I wanted to say value creating, but then what I'm actually settling on is shaping the future of business. I think that's how we need to think about evolves. I think that's where we need to go. That's where our companies and our employees need us to go. Shaping the future of business.
I love it. Anita, thank you so much for being on the podcast. You are shaping the future of business. Really appreciate you taking the time to be with us.
Thanks, JP. Great talking with you.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR Podcast. Thanks again to Anita for sharing her insights on building a high-performing HR leadership team and why we all need a people P&L. As always, you can go to thefutureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, I think you'll enjoy my Future of HR newsletter, which is the only newsletter that's focused on helping you to elevate your career and business impact. And if you go to Future of HR right now, you can subscribe and download my HR Leaders Blueprint, which is 18 pages of real-world advice from 100-plus thought leaders with simple, actionable, and proven strategies to advance your career. And we'll be back next week with another amazing guest, Melanie Naranjo. Melanie's the Chief People Officer of Athena, which is a compliance training platform. So she is doing HR for an HR tech company. In my conversation with Melanie, we get into a little bit more what it's like to be in an HR tech company, but more importantly, how she's built a LinkedIn presence with thoughtful posts that connects others and builds our HR community. If you're following or you're a fan of Melanie, you're not going to want to miss this episode. It's a great one. Thanks again for listening to the Future of HR and being part of our community.